Lunch with Leon is brought to you by Total Care, the UK experts in lifting and testing equipment for commercial vehicle workshops. Visit totalcare.co.uk and learn about their market-leading mobile column lifts, fixed post lifts, brake testers, inspection pits, and more. Total Care, lifting business one vehicle at a time.
A long time ago, a radical new approach to public transport design arrived and swept away the conventional thinking of the past. Now across UK, Europe and the world, the genius of the legend which is Ray Stenning is demonstrated on the inside and outside of road and rail vehicles and company identities. Teased out of his naturally shy disposition, that legend has lunch with Leon.
So Ray, we've been through this dreadful pandemic. I don't know about you, but one of the things that really upset me when I was using public transport during the serious bits of lockdown is that public transport operators, and that's rail as well as bus and coach, had managed to make their premises and their vehicles look like a sort of nuclear fallout zone with yellow and black tape and keep off and stay away and some terrible messages, which to me just looked absolutely awful. No wonder passengers haven't come back to us. What do you think?
Yeah, well, that is exactly what they've done. And I think the reason people do that, it's a knee-jerk reaction. They don't think, and this is in all aspects of life often, people don't think things through or think it through in the right way. It's almost, oh, we must do this, and therefore they do it. And if you criticize them, they sort of say, well, we had to do something. Yeah, we'll do the right thing, not just anything. And it's because they don't know. I suspect that's the main reason. Someone doesn't know how to make it work but look good. They just don't know, and they don't know they don't know is probably the worst aspect of that.
There was a terrible publicity photograph for National Express which showed somebody basically in a chemical warfare suit with a big thing squirting chemical inside a coach, and it was trying to say we're doing extra cleaning for your benefit, but it looked like this is such a hazard I wouldn't come anywhere near it if I were you. And I
well, exactly. No, you're absolutely right. That is the thing, is people don't always understand the undertow or the message that they are that they don't know they're giving out. So they're saying, well, look, we're cleaning it, but actually no, they're showing that it's dirty and filthy, and worse than that, it's in a hazmat suit. I mean, it suggests it is a nuclear fallout zone. The emphasis should be on the being a clean environment, not the cleaning of the environment.
I was really surprised about this, because I think we know, don't we, that there's not a single case being found of evidence of COVID anywhere on the public transport system, you know, both in terms of touch points and air quality. Even the Japanese, who are famous for cramming people on their trains, were still cramming people on their trains. And I'm afraid I think that scare story has added to what was always going to be bad news for public transport. And I fear we've lost at least 15% of our travellers forever.
I think you're right. When this started and we kept seeing all these things and you know, particularly with the government saying, almost suggesting don't use public transport, it's another nail in the coffin, really. I died a death every time I heard it.
Yes, indeed. And the other thing we've had, of course, is that I think after 30 years of trying to get people out of their cars and the sort of moving on of the generations, we had started to get some really dyed-in-the-wool car users onto public transport for a whole series of reasons. Everything from being able to have a drink and not drive, everything about it being too expensive to park or impossible to park at the far end. And we got some of those people just over the hill onto public transport. And all of a sudden, bang, they're back in their cars now, because their car is just another room in their house. They're satisfied with the cleanliness of it, and they're just there on their own. And, you know, all those people, after all that work, I'm afraid we've lost again.
Yeah, and I think when you think back, actually, it took us a good number of years. I mean, because to get them to convert or think about converting, and if we've made it unattractive to them, it's probably twice the time. It would take twice as long to get them back yet again. So say, for example, that was taking over a period of, say, 5 or 6 years, 7 years. Well, we've got 14 years in that case to go to get back to where we were trying to get them back again.
And the other one I've seen some shocking posters and notices, both in terms of the English, in terms of the message, and in terms of the way in which it's all displayed. And there's a sort of notice board anarchy, isn't there, of sticking stuff on top of other stuff on top of other stuff. And then when you actually get to read it, it's written in the most extraordinary attempt at military language, you know, like, you will comply with these instructions or you'll be shot. And some of it's untrue. I was on a bus, truthfully, the other day, where it said it was the law to wear a face mask. It wasn't in London, but actually in London, it's part of the conditions of carriage, but it's not an offence. And outside London, it's not even in the conditions of carriage. So these things are actually wrong. And I shudder, and I'm just forever thinking, you want to find the person that wrote it, the person that was the manager, and the person who fixed it, and get the three of them in a room together and give them a good duffing up, don't you?
Absolutely. There was one nameless company. I think, if I remember correctly, they put out notices saying, we have conformed with all current guidelines or legislation or words to that effect. In other words, we're not here to help you. We're just here to sort of cover our backsides. And again, as I said earlier, I think people don't always understand the messages, that the other messages that they don't mean to give out, that they are giving out at the same time. It's a bit like when someone says something, you know, deeply offensive and doesn't know it, and they say, well, I only said that, I was only speaking the truth. It's not just what you say, it's how you deliver it, the, you know, everything around the message. It's not just the bald words. But in the, I don't know what it is in the public industry, there's always this awful tendency to think the only way to solve any problem is to stick a notice up.
Yes.
There was a famous incident. You may cut this out if you think it's a little bit too risque, but a certain a lady complained to one bus company that a gentleman was doing something at the back of the bus that he shouldn't have been doing. And she said to the company, couldn't they put up a notice or something?
Yes. As if anybody that's doing something they shouldn't be doing is going to be persuaded. That's rather like having a sign that says, no shoplifting. I mean,
I know. And there's some of these things that we have to put a notice up that says, no this, no that. And you just think, oh, all right, let's take that to extreme. No murdering, no. I mean, it's nuts. And the thing is, I've said this over and over again. If someone hasn't read your notice, basically you haven't spoken to them. Communication is a two-way process.
Completely.
If they don't hear what you're saying, you might as well have not said it.
Which is why some of the stuff, Ray, I know that you've done with some of your clients, of course, has been to lighten up some of this, hasn't it? Mm. To say some nice things. So instead, you know, instead of saying, do not do this, you find a light-hearted way of saying it, which, of course, just completely transforms the communication, because it makes the bus feel human, doesn't it? It feels like people are being...
No, you're right. I do remember a while ago we had someone, they wanted to put a notice up saying, we can only carry 5 buggies on this bus, or something like that. I can't remember what it was. So we just said, well, actually, a nicer way to put it is we can carry up to 5 buggies on this bus.
Yes.
Which, you know, it explains exactly the same thing, but it's done as a positive message, not a admonishing, hard message.
No.
That's what the art of communication is. It's a two-way process. Even if you're only doing it one way, you have to regard it as a two-way process.
And I also wonder whether the authors of some of this stuff have ever realised that phrases like curtail to terminate at is gobbledygook. You know, I mean, nobody in real life says, I'm going to be curtailed to terminate at. You know, they might say stop. So I think this art, which you and I think have spent some time trying to improve, has gotten so much worse, I think, during the coronavirus, I guess is my point.
I think so too. And I think you also, the one that sort of bugs me a little bit, although it's a very nice word, it is the correct word, but when you use the word, you know, a light here for something, for someone who English is not their first language or whatever. I mean, maybe they've never learnt the word. You know, if you have limited vocabulary, what does a light mean? It's sometimes, you just have, again, it's that thing, you have to take into consideration everything around the message. You know, your audience, will they understand what you're saying?
Indeed.
And you can't then fall back and sort of say, well, if you can't understand it, that's your fault. because that is the sub-message you're giving out if you're not careful.
And also, you have to be careful with guidelines. So there were some guidelines for an unnamed public transport operator many years ago, which tried to be helpful. And the guidelines for the notices and signs and so on was that it had to be accurate, it had to be capable of not being misinterpreted, and it had to be positive. And actually, if you added all the guidelines together, the rule about if you have a dog, it must go upstairs, unless it's a guide dog, in which case it can go downstairs. The only way to comply with the guidelines would be to say, if there are two of you and one of you is a dog, then both of you must go on the upper deck unless the human is blind. which I think is just lovely, but of course entirely impractical.
Yeah, and it's like when they stick these stupid notices up with, you know, service revisions, and it's on a piece of A4 and it's done in about 8-point type all the way over, and it's stuck behind the driver, so the only person who can read it is the person sitting in that first seat. and then they have the gall to say things like, you know, well, we put up our notice, didn't you read it, are you that stupid? And you know, is that is not how to get people to like using public transport.
No, for sure. I know one of your other pet hates is that operators cover the windows, the way in which passengers see out, with external advertising or other forms of stuff. And I always remember you saying to me that, you know, you don't put things on your windows at home, so why on earth would you expect to see it on public transport?
But they used to put Bobber Job stickers up on windows, didn't they? So the next a number of times, you know, I've heard people sort of say, you know, oh, well, it still lets a lot of light in. That's all that matters, as long as light comes in. I mean, one of the joys of public transport, particularly, you know, upstairs on a bus, is the views. I mean, they're tremendous. And I mean, on a train, I know people do all sorts of things on the train, on their laptop or looking at the screen, watching a film and all sorts of things. But there are still people that like to look out of windows. It's ridiculous covering over. I mean, glass is made clear for a reason. So why make it unclear?
And I know you've also been involved, Ray, in not just how the thing looks, but actually in really deeply into the design. Both externally and especially internally, to make passenger transport look inviting and friendly.
Yeah.
So you've single-handedly done that with some spectacularly good examples across the UK, but it's still not widespread, is it? There's still quite a lot of bad design out there, both from the manufacturers and from the operators.
Yeah, I mean, I've thought about this an awful lot as to why, and I sometimes half-jokingly refer to my profession and people who practice it, and particularly me, I guess, you know, we're magicians, and people distrust magicians. They don't like the dark arts, and there are certain functions, shall we say, in a transport company, where your brain is wired in such a way that you don't, it's not your job to understand it. I mean, if you're an accountants, for example, are wonderful people, in case any accountants are listening to this. No, you are accountants. I love you, love you, love you, love you, lots, lots. No, they're great people and they've got great skills, but those skills don't really, if your brain is wired to love figures and manipulate figures and add figures up, take them away, whatever you do with figures, fine. It's a very much an on-off sort of a very disciplined, a very strict thing. Well, design is a fluid process. It's never sort of, you know, it is or it isn't. It's on, it's off, it's black, it's white. It moves, it bends, it flows, it all sorts of things. And that's the sort of stuff we do. And if people don't understand it, they don't trust it. If they don't trust it, they don't believe it. If they don't believe it, they don't like it. And so it goes. And a lot of people, they don't understand it, as I said, so can't accept that it can make a difference. But I mean, in everything we do, we are deeply controlled, even, but certainly influenced by things around us. And I, if you don't understand it, leave it to those that do, he said lecturingly. Well, we have to. I mean, I know what I'm bloody love talking about.
Indeed. And look, Ray, a number of your happy customers have said things in the past like, it's worth paying a bit extra to get Ray to do that, which I think is a great compliment, because people recognize there is a cost attached to doing some of this, but that it's worth it. It's worth that cost because of all the subliminal advantages that it gives. So,
isn't it pays dividends? It really does. I mean, I may be repeating myself because this story I may have told before, but someone, an accountant actually, I mustn't keep going on, must I? It's not very nice. Anyway, this accountant, after we'd had a meeting, and he said, all this money I'm giving you, you know, where do I get my return on investment sort of thing? And I said, well, A, you're not giving me money, you're paying me to do a job of work, and it's not your money anyway, it's the company's money, I added in. And I said, you'll get absolutely no return on investment whatsoever. You know, his eyes lit up and full of glee. You know, he'd got me. And I said, but further down the line, there's lots of things you will be doing, and that will be a hell of a lot easier. And you'll get much bigger returns on the money you fork out, because I'm giving you a beautiful, firm foundation on which to build. That's how it works. So, yeah.
Well, I can
so
just
don't cross me. You'll get a fucking great flea in your ear. No, joking apart.
But actually, good design is worth having, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It helps drive revenue. It certainly drives customer satisfaction. It makes life easier for everybody, whether you be staff, whether you be customers. It just makes life easier, I think, for everybody, because, as you said earlier, it's exploiting what good communication can do for you.
Yeah. I mean, if someone gets on, let's take a bus as an example, they get on a bus and it looks nice, it feels nice, it's got a nice ambience, the sort of, say, it feels right, they are far more likely to look forward to travelling on that bus again. And the converse, if it is just a sea of dull grey and dull this and dull that and drab and dreary and everything else, they're not going to actually say, that was a great journey, I want to do it again. They're going to find reasons not to do it. And you make your money on your repeat business at the end of the day. And you want nice, happy people, people who sort of get off the bus, you know, that was a great experience. And that's what it's all about at the end of the day.
And they want to do it again. And frankly, we should be no less sophisticated than any other retailer in making sure that people have a happy experience and part with their money as willingly as possible. And that's what happens in supermarkets, that's what happens in major retail. And if major retailers were as careless as the public transport industry has been seen to be in the past, then they would not have done so well, and many of these brands would not have survived.
No, absolutely. I mean, and you know, they understand that it is an investment, not a cost.
You know, I'm going to say this, but for example, the amount of effort that Apple puts into its packaging is extraordinary. And when you're opening something for the first time, it's really clear. There's one strip that you pull and everything else just opens out around it. If you're taking the lid off a box, it's been measured precisely so that the box comes off in a damped way, so it doesn't just fall off, and neither is it impossible to get off. The lid is designed so that as you lift it out, it comes out in a really smooth way. So you're feeling, you know, you're already feeling happy about the product, and you're still only in the packaging.
Oh, no, and quite, and sometimes even the sound the packaging makes.
Yeah.
You know, they're using the right sort of tissue paper or something, or whatever they use. It's all part of, we're affected by all these things. You know, it changes our mood, it changes our perception of things. There have been tests done where, you know, identical products and presented in different ways, and people will think one is better than the other when they're absolutely identical.
The legend meets the future as ITT Hub prepares for its second exciting show all about information and technology in transport. Industry designer Ray Stenning steps out to have lunch with Leon.
I'm glad to see we've made some progress over the years, and we are a bit more like a retailer than we were. I'm just wondering now, as we're getting what is clearly much more central control from the Department for Transport and the local authorities as a result of the government policy that's in the new strategy document, I just wonder where some of that will go, because local authorities in particular are not known as great retailers. And I wonder whether this increased influence of the public sector will cause some of the retail lessons that we've learned. I just wonder whether some of that will be lost as we go forward.
It could well be, but I mean, that's why we must train, we must educate, you know, up and coming people to understand the importance of things like this. I mean, I've given some presentations in the past, and I believe I've got to do one again next year to the young bus managers. And it's amazing. I seem to remember I was talking about, you know, the power of design to this group some while ago. And some of them are sort of saying, wow, no one's ever told us that before. You know, and you just think, well, yeah, because they don't know. If you don't understand something, you tend to fear it, which means you fight against it.
Sure.
So we've always got that to put up with. So, you know, I think, yeah, we might have a bit of an uphill struggle.
Yeah, look, Ray, I agree with you entirely. We do have to educate, of course, the people coming through. As I say, I've got a bit of a concern as to what the new central control, you know, the dead hand of central planning, as it used to be called. I wonder how much of the entrepreneurial flair that we've seen with Martin Gilbert and Alex Hornby and others, I just wonder how much of that, if you like, that entrepreneurial flair will be lost as we move into the next stage, and equally for rail, where again the operators will be less bothered about attracting extra revenue.
Yeah, I think one thing though I've noticed over the years is that once you get big organisations, whether it be a, you know, transport group or a, you know, local authority or whatever it is, sometimes the people within it lose sight of the end product. I mean, we are, in many ways, we're an artisan business. Every single journey made is an individual journey. The circumstances around that journey can be very different. You know, the weather can be different. The purpose of the journey can be different. Lots and lots of things are different. And in one part of the country or even one part of a city, one journey is not the same as somewhere else. It's not like buying, you know, a packet of digestive biscuits. And we must always realise that. And I've noticed within big organisations, sometimes, say, for example, a marketing department just assumes the end product, or at least, sorry, the thing that you make the journey on, the bus, in other words, or the train, is perfect. I've noticed this over and over again, that they're interested in the theory and the sort of, you know, rolling out something all over the place, without taking into account the individual characteristics of whatever it is. It's a bit worrying, really, I think.
Indeed. And two or three episodes ago, I had Matthew Niblett and Chris Bure talking about their new book called Why Travel. And the main thrust of the book, of course, is that we have spent quite a lot of time developing a presumption that travel is bad. And therefore, it must be as fast as possible. It must be as short as possible. It must be just something to be avoided. And the main thrust, of course, is from them, is that this is a ridiculous place to be, because travel ought to be enjoyable, and travel, you know, travel ought to be fun. It ought to be part of going on holiday. It's part of that decompressing you do between work and home. It's your opportunity to read. It's your opportunity to think. And that far from trying to get journeys to be faster and less intrusive, there is something to be really enjoyed about the whole thing. And I'm thinking now, post COVID, where it looks like business travel is down but leisure travel is up, that actually we might need to develop that even further and make the journey in its widest sense much more enjoyable, as opposed to something frankly to be avoided.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, I'm a great believer in making the journey the best it can be. And I think there's a danger in big organisations that they see, particularly with the rise of the worship, shall we say, of statistics and data, it removes the individual from the whole, you know, the perception of it. We're not carrying lumps of human cargo. They are people. I mean, an example being, someone can get on the bus in the morning, going to work, shopping, or whatever it is. They could have had a blazing row with their nearest and dearest that morning, and the journey, the driver and the journey has the power to sort of calm them possibly, or even remove, you know, their anxiety, whatever it is. But if the driver is surly or rude or just sort of just says the wrong thing, the bus is drab and uncomfortable, noisy, that will just exacerbate any sort of, you know, their malaise that they have. And you know, as I say, these are individual people, and they're even individual. Each day they travel, they have different, you know, there's different things happening in their lives. They can be happy one day, sad another day, miserable, what have you. And we should make that journey, as I keep on saying, the best it can be.
Yeah.
And I think there's a danger. We do see them as just cargo. You know, they get on the bus and they switch off till they get off the bus. And that's not true. I mean, we love journeys. I mean, you know, a daily commute, you know, you've got time to do whatever you do on a commute.
Ray, I always said that in the days when I didn't have enough travelling, I didn't get all my reading done. Because actually,
it's true. It's true.
The journey was the time to do the reading because it's broadly uninterrupted. And if I didn't have a long rail journey or a flight or any sort of decent journey, then I got behind on my reading. And in fact, that became especially clear during lockdown when we weren't doing so many journeys. So that completely kills the argument that the government has always had, which is that there is some benefit to speeding up journeys. Because it assumes that journeys are dead time. But in fact, journeys are not dead time. Journeys are, for many people, very productive time. In my case, extra productive time, because as I say, it's when I do most of my reading. And on that basis, the business case for speeding things up, on the basis that you'll get to Birmingham 10 minutes quicker, so you'll have an extra 10 minutes of productive time, is just wrong. That's not an argument for not building, for example, HS2. Lots of good reasons to build HS2.
Yeah, I think it depends. I mean, the thing about speed can be exhilarating. It can be fun. I mean, I was going to the south of France all the way by public transport. And the TGV from Paris south down to, I think it was Montpellier, I was going to. I didn't really care how long it took, but I did enjoy the sensation of speed. But it wasn't because I wanted to be there incredibly quickly. But you know, the journey was nice. It was pleasant. And, you know, gaze out the window, read a bit, look out the window, do a bit of work, what have you.
Sure.
And the speed was one of those things. But it wasn't the sort of like, you know, I must get there as quickly as possible and I don't care about anything else. I mean, all our experiences are related to each other. All our, you know, the feelings we get when we travel, it's getting the right balance between,
yep,
you know, speed and slow, between comfort and it's a mix, isn't it?
It is. So interesting changes in the industry, Ray. We're seeing some consolidation now, aren't we? So National Express and Stagecoach, RATP Dev with Tower Transit and so on. I mean, these, yeah, are all signs, aren't they, of a declining market. Where do you think we're going in the future with this?
It's difficult to know, but one little thing often in my mind, and we talk about car-led recovery and, you know, the whole role of public transport. But if we're going to make public transport take its sort of rightful role in society, which means we need more of it, and not only do we have to make it a lot better, and from my personal perspective and my, if you like, my mission, my purpose in life is to make it, you know, incredibly attractive and appealing. I think one thing that there have to be curtailments on private, you know, individual sort of, unbridled use of cars. There have to be controls over, you know, how, where, when we use cars, anything like that. And people talk about, oh, well, cars, you know, bring freedom. But for every freedom they bring to the person that they bring freedom to, they actually, it's stopping, curtailing someone else's freedoms. I have chosen not to have my own, apart from a bicycle, my own personal mobility. I don't want to drive. I've driven cars, I've driven motorbikes, I've driven buses, coaches, you know. Just don't want to drive anymore. So what about that? It's a choice, a matter of choice. Don't I have shouldn't my needs of not wanting to drive be catered for as much as the person who does want to drive?
Yes, and I think successive governments have tried this a bit, haven't they? But of course, it's politically toxic because single-use motorists, if you like, also vote. And I think
and they believe they're the only ones that do vote. If you haven't got a car, you haven't got the ability to vote, is their view.
That's true. And in fact, I have a number of these conversations where people are saying there's a war on the motorist. There is, in fact, a rebalancing away from the private motorist for sure, but that's because they are the least efficient users of road space and at the upper end of causing pollution. Whereas at the other end, walking and cycling, dare I say it, and public transport are at the efficient and less polluting end of the scale. So it's not a war on the private motorist, it's a rebalancing of things back to the middle, where there's fairness for everybody. And we do know it doesn't matter how many lanes you build, traffic will expand to fill it, whether it's four lanes or six lanes or eight lanes. We don't want our places to look like Los Angeles.
If you just go on Google Street View and look at big cities, particularly in America, the amount of space taken up for cars to be there, even if they're not there at that moment. I mean, car parks are outside big shopping centres and all over the place. We can't go on like that anymore. It's causing untold harm.
It is, and I think we've had the benefit recently of the green agenda. But I'm frightened now that the trouble is that although the green agenda has helped push public transport along the road, as it were, the danger is now that with the widespread availability of zero emission cars, that link between congestion and air quality will be lost, because a city full of electric cars will still be a city going nowhere.
Yeah.
And the air quality argument, of course, is lost. I'm just waiting for government to get its act together on this, because in its pursuit of air quality, it is providing huge fiscal advantages for people to have zero emission cars. And once this genie is out of the bottle, it won't go back in again. And it certainly won't go back in on the air quality agenda, because there'll be that smug look, with apologies to drivers of electric vehicles, that smug look that says, I can drive my car anywhere I like because I'm not causing any pollution.
Well, that's another reason where, and I think people are foolish, and particularly, government is foolish when it thinks that just by saying, you must all use public transport more and more, blah, 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 it's going to happen. I mean, from my point of view, that's another reason why we have to make people actually say, well, this bus, this train, it's wonderful, it's such a lovely thing to be on, and my car is quite small and cramped, and although it's got all these advantages, it's not quite as nice. So, I mean, it's another reason why we have to up the ante in terms of the presentation of the product, and not just the vehicle, but everything around it, how we present and give out information, how we advertise, promote, the whole lot. We've got to just make public transport desirable, as is my phrase, because it ain't yet.
So there we have it. What a wonderful way to end our mission as ever, even at our age, Ray. Our mission as ever is to make
your bloody self
is to make public transport desirable, because if we make it desirable, then we will have enough customers. And if we have enough customers, we'll have enough money, and it will be a virtuous circle. Contributes to the country, contributes to the economy, and of course, improves air quality. So my guest today on Lunch with Leon has been Ray Stenning, the master designer, author of numerous beautifully designed vehicles, rail vehicles, as well as road vehicles, their liveries, their signage, their design, their interior design. And you can see Ray's work all over the country. Indeed, you can see it all over the world. And Ray, it must be really lovely to travel across in this country and see your handiwork on display and just sit there quietly, that nobody on the bus knows that it was you who designed it. So thanks very much for coming on this week's Lunch with Leon, which is an ITTHub.net production. If you go across to our website, you'll see details of this and our other podcasts, our news channel, and of course, all the latest news about ITT Hub itself, which will be at Farnborough in May 2022. In the meantime, thanks for joining us. And Ray Stenning, thanks very much indeed.
Thank you, Leon.